Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. This is your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. I actually think that this is one of the most needed shows on the internet today. We tell the truth, and we tell it with courage, and we tell it with integrity. And today, with things like the wars are still raging, torture is still flourishing, our country is going bankrupt. May was one of the deadliest months for our troops in Iraq, not to mention the people of Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan. And it seems like our leaders are going insane. My friend Greg wrote me, and he has been telling me all along for the past year or so to give Obama a chance. Just give him a chance. Let him do the job, and he thinks that he's going to do a good job. Well, I sent out a thing today about how Obama has not only appointed McChrystal, Cheney's general, as head of Afghanistan, the AFPAC now they call it. He has appointed another McHugh, another Republican, as Secretary of the Army. And today he just appointed Jim Leach as the Director of the Humanities here in America. Jim Leach, a Republican who was responsible or partly responsible for the Graham-Blidley-Leach Act, which overturned Glass-Steagall, which was a Depression-era protection to stop things like Citigroup happening, to stop the consolidation of companies like AIG to make them too big to fail, which is really causing our collapse right now. And I don't think there's any difference between a Democrat and a Republican. But, you know, aren't there any qualified Democrats that Obama could appoint for these? If I was a Democrat, I would be getting pretty upset right now. And my friend Greg finally is upset. I sent out that article and Greg said, "I hate that Chicago blank." I can't say what he called him. I hate him now. And that's the thing I'm trying to say is don't hate anybody. Don't hate a person. It's the system. The system has institutional momentum. Even if Barack Obama wanted to do the right thing, even if George Bush wanted to do the right thing, the system will always prevent them from doing so. So in honor of my first guest today, my first guest is Richard Brown, who was falsely accused of murdering a policeman here in San Francisco in 1971 as part of the Black Panther Party. I'm wearing a shirt that says "Arrest Bush." Richard was falsely arrested from a confession that was garnered by some of his friends being tortured into admission. And I think that Jerry Brown should not be going after the San Francisco 8. Jerry Brown should be going after George Bush and Dick Cheney. One of my first guests was Vincent Bugliosi. And I'm just calling on Jerry Brown right now to press charges against George Bush and Dick Cheney for murder and to drop the charges against the San Francisco 8. When we come back, we'll be talking to Richard Brown. Please stay tuned.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
This is Jamie Romano of James Communications. We are living in such exciting times. Never before in history has the global community come together in solidarity as we are now. Wonderful work is being done locally, nationally, and globally on every human and environmental issue that needs to be addressed. I developed James Communications to help you maximize your contribution to the world. Whether you're a small group, a large organization, or an individual with an altruistic dream, if you're working in service to humanity or the planet, James Communications will work with you to streamline efficiency and strengthen the impact of your cause or campaign. For more information on how James Communications can help you do what you do, please visit www.jamescommunications.com.
Special guest today at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox is Black Panther Richard Brown. Richard lives in San Francisco. He's been working in the community here since he was a member of the Black Panther Party. He's involved in the San Francisco 8 trial, 8 Black Panthers who were falsely accused of murdering police officer John Young in 1971. The pretrial is starting on Monday. We have Richard Brown here in the studio today. Richard, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you so very much, dear.
Well, thank you for taking the time to come into my studio, to my program. I was telling you, it's always exciting to have someone in the studio because usually we have
for me too.
Usually we have phone interviews. But like I introduced you, you were a member of the Black Panther Party.
Correct.
And there's a lot of misperceptions, I think, about the Black Panther Party. And they're mostly pushed on us by, you know, the
media.
Propaganda media. Yeah. Yep. And who was it? Was it Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, who said you were one of the biggest, the Black Panthers were one of the biggest threats to the United States, internal threats to the United States of America. But tell me, you were in San Francisco.
Yes.
And you were a member of the Black Panther Party. Yes, or were you a member of the Splinter Party?
No, I was a member of the Black Panther Party when it started from the beginning. Actually, I went to Oakland and started, and then they brought us, started a chapter here in San Francisco. So, yeah, I was a member of the original Black Panther Party.
And why did the Black Panther Party form? Why did it exist?
Because of the many, many problems that existed in the Black community. Because of the lack of opportunities that we had. Because of the lack of elected officials representing us,
right.
Because we needed housing, we needed education, we were last in everything, and I think in Fillmore at that time, the unemployment was 50% for young Black males, which I happened to be one, so we just felt that this country didn't have anything to offer us. We weren't going anywhere, and when Bobby and Huey came by and said we had the right to determine our own destiny,
right.
And came up with a real platform and a program, most of us jumped at it.
Tell my listeners who Bobby and Huey are.
Bobby Seale and Huey P. Newton, they were the original founders of the Black Panther Party.
Was the Black Panther Party, was it formulated or formed to be a political force or a social force in the communities?
Well, actually, when it first started out, it was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. We were focusing on actually monitoring the police activities in the Black community because then, as now, there was a lot of police brutality on Black people in the Black community. There were a lot of shootings. There were a lot of killings. And it was like then and now. It was always justifiable homicide when an unarmed Black man would be
right.
Shot down in the streets. So
an unarmed Black man.
Yeah.
Right.
Know, so what we did was Bobby and Huey, who knew the law,
mm-hmm.
We used to monitor the activities of the police in the Black community. We would follow them and make sure that people weren't railroaded, their constitutional rights weren't violated.
Mm-hmm.
We would stand a legal distance and observe. And at that time, it was legal to have shotguns and pistols and that type of thing, and the Panther Party carried them. So it put an end to the police brutality in the community. And people, that's how we got started. People quickly told us that, you know, that's well and good, but we have more problems than just, you know, police brutality.
Do you know Larry Pinkney?
Larry Pinkney?
Yes.
I think I remember. I'm not sure.
He was on one of my very early shows. He writes for a website called black commentator.
Oh, okay. The name's familiar. Yeah, I do know who you're talking about.
So he was a Black Panther also in the Midwest. And he's you know, one of his things is he was a community organizer that provided services to people.
Well, that's what
and then when Barack Obama
says,
you know, when people say Barack Obama was a community organizer, he's like, no, he didn't really organize anything and didn't sacrifice anything. So tell me what you did here in San Francisco.
Well, the first thing we did, we listened to the community people. We formed black captains and sub-captains, and we went around and we talked to everyone in our community to find out what the problems were and how and what best way we could serve our community, which gave us a good idea of what people really wanted, which we knew that in order for us to be surviving, in order for us to be able to grow, we had to be the community had to support us.
Right.
So, and we could do that by simply serving their needs. And that's what we did. We had the Breakfast for Children program, which was extremely successful.
Absolutely.
Which J. Edgar Hoover hated above all else because he claimed it embarrassed the government because they were saying they couldn't do it. It couldn't be done.
Right.
Even with all their resources. And we were doing it with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's successfully, very successful.
One of your major successes.
And we had a... We started our own clinics. We had clinics. We started our own sickle cell drives in order to test people. We helped with the – we had rent strikes in order – we had a lot of slumlords who would do nothing for the property in the black community. So we would take the rent and we would fix the property up or withhold it until we got their attention and fix some of the things that needed to be fixed. We had clothing drives. We had food drives. We had one of the things that I particularly liked was working with people who really needed, vulnerable people in the community, particularly the elderly.
Mm-hmm.
You had a lot of people at that time who were preying on the elderly whenever they would get their checks on the first.
Right.
They would, you know, get robbed when they went to the store, mm-hmm. to the bank. And we started an escort, senior escort service, in which we would pick them up and take them to shop or take them to the bank or take them wherever they had to go, to the doctors and That was very nice. They really appreciated that, and it stopped a lot of stuff. We really dealt with the crime in our communities.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to put a stop to the drugs and to the prostitution that was going on. And ironically, that's when most of our problems started with the police. When we started dealing with trying to stop drugs in the community and stop the prostitution, the police focused on us and started arresting us to keep us from harassing the dope dealers and the pimps. So. That was even more so than us monitoring them,
right?
With guns, they hated that, of course. But the real problem started when we started trying to clean up the crime in our community and stop the violence and that type of thing.
Right. You know, that is something that I think what I call the robber class likes to foment in communities. So you can't, here you were providing this valuable service, like you said, and you were getting support in the community, and
absolutely.
And you were gathering together, right? You were forming community.
Forming communities, all different kinds. Once we started, we reached out to a lot of people, different groups. We believe in coalitions with anyone who believed in freedom, justice, and equality.
Mm-hmm.
We started mixing with the other ethnic groups and that type of thing. There was the Brown Berets, there was the Pink Panthers and the Gray Panthers,
right.
and the Red Guard. You know, we had a lot of coalitions. And with the Peace and Freedom Party, we believed in working with people in order to try to strengthen the communities, all communities. And because of the services that we were providing to communities, we started to grow nationwide.
Of course. People started,
you know, and before they knew it, we were nationwide. And we had our own newspaper. We started the Black Panther newspaper, and it was going worldwide. We were sending our newspaper to countries that that the United States didn't even have, that they couldn't send the Chronicle to, you
right.
know. But they would accept the Black
Such
Panther
as
newspaper. Cuba, China, mm-hmm. you know, at that time.
Before Nixon normalized relations.
Yeah, so we were able to, those are just a couple of countries. Algiers, you know, a lot of places that mm-hmm. that the United States was actually having problems with no diplomatic immunity with them.
Right.
We were able to get our papers sent there. And that was actually the first time that I honestly think that we came across the CIA, because trying to get our papers to other countries is when they started sabotaging the newspapers, setting them on fire, soaking them with gasoline, or making sure that they got lost and that type of stuff. So,
well, I do want to talk about the COINTELPRO campaign, war against the Black Panthers.
Yeah, the Black Panthers.
But one thing I want to ask you before we talk about that is, does what the services that the Black Panthers provided and in the community and the support they got, and of course demonized and undermined by the propaganda media and by the FBI, CIA. Right. Does that remind you, or do you even want to be associated with, like, what happens in Palestine with Hamas and Hezbollah? That they get support from the people because they provide services
to the people. And they're demonized by the press because, you know, the powers that be, the corporate America, you know. Anytime you have someone who, when you have a people who are being exploited, and you have someone who represents them and tries to organize them and show them that they have the right to fight back and that they can successfully fight back and do for themselves, those people are going to be focused on. And they're going to be hunted down, and they're not, you know, they're going to do everything they can to destroy them, just as they focused on the Black Panther Party. And Nixon turned J. Edgar Hoover loose on us, and the counterintelligence program, it literally destroyed the Black Panther Party as it was known.
Well, let's talk about that. We have about 10 more minutes in this segment. Let's talk about the organized, coordinated attack against the Black Panther Party by COINTELPRO.
Yeah, well, you know, and what's so strange or what's so unusual is we had no idea at that time how extensive the attack was, how much they were focused.
We're doing good.
Yeah, we were naive, and we had no idea that these people were plotting against us and doing these things at first. Now, you know, we knew we always had problems with the local police, but we didn't know that it was actually the counterintelligence program that was manipulating them in the background and using them as the frontline troops in order to be able to help undermine the party. As far as attacking our leadership, as far as framing people, as far as planting evidence and falsifying evidence and falsifying reports against people, which was done to me several times. As far as even murder, Fred Hampton was murdered.
Right.
Bunchy Carter and John Huggins in L.A. were murdered. And according to the counterintelligence program, according to their own memos, they were responsible for it, even though they didn't pull the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
They sent memos around bragging on how their actions brought about the death of certain people, certain Panthers. We lost a lot of Panthers. A lot of Panthers were killed between 69 and 71 and 72. A lot, especially in L.A. I think it was something like over 20 Panthers were killed in L.A. alone, you know.
Well, and that's where I lived during that time. I was a young girl, and the propaganda was so deep, you know, you were thinking that, if we knew the term terrorist back then, that it was terrorists being killed and our community was way better off because that happened. Right. And you see it today with the abortion provider being killed the other day. The media, you know, people like Fox News, you know, they whip people into a frenzy. And it might be a person that pulls a trigger, but like you said, it's a coordinated conspiracy behind that, isn't there?
And they orchestrate it and get it going. And the way they go about it, particularly the counterintelligence program, they were devious. I mean, they planned it. They started this rift between the Black Panther Party and US organization, and they did it by sending letters or making phone calls to the Black Panther office and saying, you know, this is the US organization, we're going to come in and we're going to do this to you, we're going to do that. And then they'd send a letter with Black Panther stationery to the US organization saying, you guys are this and you're that, and you know, all of you are, you know, just they just got it going. And naturally they had provocateurs and agents working.
I was just about to ask you that. Infiltrators
in the party and all the other organizations. And their job wasn't just to, like, a lot of times they would just come in, when we had the office on Fillmore Street in San Francisco, people joined and we'd have them fill out applications. And at first, we welcomed any and everybody that wanted to join a Black Panther Party.
Right.
We quickly learned that a lot of people who came there everybody who came through the doors weren't our friends. So, and that was because some people would come in and they would go and sit down in the office or go to use the bathroom and drop off a gun in there or in the tank or put drugs in under the trash can. And then when the police come and raid the place, they go right to it
right,
and find
it.
We learned quickly to not let just everybody come in, and that was to try to keep us from growing, but we still did anyway. We just watched ourselves with who could come into our office and who could come into our homes. But with the counterintelligence program, they use people to do that. They use people to testify against us falsely. They would, manufacture evidence.
I'm sure they bought people off
our own government said that when they investigated them that they were unconstitutional and illegal. They came up with over 300 criminal acts that the counterintelligence program was guilty of, and they disbanded them. They never had held anybody accountable for the things that they did. I think a couple of people were convicted and actually were about to be sentenced, and the president gave them a pardon. So nobody has ever been held accountable. For things like Geronimo being arrested and falsifying evidence against him or withholding evidence, actually. And that man, during 27 years, when the government knew that it was impossible for him to have committed the murder because they had him under surveillance 500 miles away and they had the tapes and everything and refused to allow it to be brought to light in the trial. So he was convicted of a murder, just like they're trying to convict the eight of us, and served 27 years before Stuart Hanlon was able to force the documents out and prove.
That's a third of most people's lifetimes.
Absolutely.
That's just...
that's horrible.
It is.
Something like that to a human being, and you know for a fact that you're doing that, that you're destroying him. So, those type of people, I am yet... trying to figure out how people could hate and be. And most of them probably were just doing a job. I don't know. I mean, they couldn't have known us personally.
Right.
But they could do things like that to us and justify it.
Well, that makes it, I think
night.
To me, that makes it even worse.
Yeah, that's what
if
I'm
you,
saying.
If you, like, care about something and you try to change something, it's different than just, like, getting paid for a job
that's
me is immoral and horrible.
Yeah, you have to. It takes a certain type of person, I think, to be able to do something like that to other people, to violate not only their constitutional rights or human rights, but to lock someone up or send someone to the gas chamber or to a death row, and that they're innocent.
I know that. To death row, to death.
Yeah,
so many parallels. Your case has so many parallels with what's going on today in America.
True.
I mean, let's face it. African Americans, Black people have never been treated with justice in this entire our entire history.
Correct.
And the Civil Rights Movement was getting going. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated.
Right.
Malcolm X was assassinated.
Right.
And we know that there was institutionalized Black slavery where the Blacks were beaten, forced to work, had their families killed,
sold off. Yeah.
And I just can't imagine being a mother and having your child ripped away from you. That's just something that, we know that horrible history. But also, like you said, Black people are targeted just because they're Black in this country.
That's true.
And tortured, you know, murdered,
held down,
falsely.
Opportunities denied to us,
right.
Civil rights being violated, human rights being violated.
And nothing much has changed since the 60s or the 50s or the 40s.
A little bit has changed, and it's because of the people. It's not because of the government. It's
right.
not because of corporate America, but people are becoming more educated because I've seen the stages. I'm getting up there. I'm almost 100 years old. So
no,
I've seen a change, you know. And
there are still changes. But
people,
still, Oscar Grant is still murdered. San
True.
Francisco has lost a majority of.
But you have a black man also as the president of the United States. Not that is a change.
It's
a historical
right.
event. Now
I
don't think it makes a difference as right. far as poor people or black people are concerned, but that's because of the education or that's the thinking of the people in the
right.
United States to the point. I mean, 10, 20, 25 years ago, that never could have happened. Before the civil rights, it never would have happened. But
yeah,
after,
absolutely.
Since the civil rights and that type of thing, we have made certain progress. But the forces that are out there that are still looking at black people as slaves or as second class citizens, they still want to treat us that way.
Well,
and that's why Oscar Grant was
right.
killed, and why they're trying to get Messalink off with it.
Yep. Well, let's talk about your case after
yes.
the break. So we'll be right back. This is Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. We're having a fascinating conversation with Black Panther. Are you still a Black Panther? You say you're a former
Black
Panther.
Once a Black Panther, always a Black Panther.
Yeah. Richard Brown, we'll be right back.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here at cindysheehansoapbox.com. We're talking to Richard Brown. And Richard, tell my listeners what happened on August 29th, 1971. I want you to tell us what happened, and then what were you doing on that day?
I have no idea. That was so long ago, honestly and truly. But on that day, the Ingleside Police Station was attacked, and an officer was killed. And I remember the incident. I remember the you know, more or less what was going on around that time and hearing about it and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that day or that night or what I was doing, you know, I was actually a Black Panther, so I was still serving the people. That's
right.
all I know that I was
right.
doing. And there was, if I'm not mistaken, they actually started out thinking that there were other people who were responsible for that. I think they were talking about the Weather Underground
mm-hmm.
or some other organizations of that
mm-hmm.
nature. I actually don't remember. But then again, a communique came out, so that was kind of confusing. It was so long ago. But, you know, I continued to serve in San Francisco as a Black Panther and continue to do what I did every day, and that was to go out into the community and serve the needs of the people in my community. And a couple of years later, in 1973, some Panthers were arrested in New Orleans. Now,
and who were they? What were their names?
It was about 13.
Mm-hmm. 13 of them.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Now, the three of them, John Bowman, Harold Taylor, and Reuben Scott, were tortured
mm-hmm.
horribly for 4 or 5 days. But there were other Panthers there also with their families and stuff. People had left San Francisco. A lot of Panthers went to different they went to areas of the country where they weren't known and changed their names and put their kids in school and got a job and were trying to move more or less away from that Black Panther image. And they found them in New Orleans, and they arrested them, and they had detectives come from all over the United States, from back east, from New York, and I think even from Chicago, some from L.A., New Orleans, and San Francisco. And they
Two detectives from San Francisco.
Frank McCoy and Ed Ertelatz, who were detectives that were hounding us here in San Francisco.
Were they investigating the murder?
They were homicide detectives. So I think they were assigned to the murder of Ingleside Station.
It was Sergeant John Young who was murdered that day.
Yes.
And were they... So they were investigating that murder, but they were just so the police came from all over to torture or to view the torture, hoping that there would be a forced confession for one of their murders.
Well, they knew that they could do that. What they did was came from all over the United States, people who had unsolved cases, just like Ingleside was unsolved at that time, and with through the New Orleans Police Department torturing the people, John and. Ruben and Harold, they made them confess to all of the unsolved cases, not just Ingleside, but all of everything all that was going on, any unsolved case that they had from Los Angeles all the way back to New York, and implicate other people.
And that's where you come in.
That's where I come in, and seven other people, the eight, that's where the eight come
in. San Francisco,
Now, as soon as John and Reuben and Harold got to a judge, they told them what had happened and how they'd been tortured, and it was investigated. And there were a couple of people who more or less, you know, said, yes, this happened. They found the cattle prod. They found everything, and that and the fact that they had been held 5 days in question without their attorney, the judge ruled the confessions inadmissible. And they were, you know, they'd already typed up the confessions and just had them sign it. So they threw it out. Now, at that time, they even went to Los Angeles and a couple other places. They came back to San Francisco and tried to use it, and nobody would touch it.
And what's the name of the movie about the San Francisco?
Legacy of Torture.
Legacy of Torture. And I've seen the movie, and I recommend people to check it out. The torture was unspeakable.
What
they were subjected to.
Actually, honestly, and truly.
Like we were talking about before we went on the air, this has so many parallels with what's going on today in Abu Ghraib,
and Guantanamo,
Bagram, and the black sites that we don't even know about.
Around the world,
And they're trying to, and the war started because they tortured somebody into saying there was a link between Saddam and Osama. And
that's never weapons of mass destruction.
That's never admissible, right? Confessions that are gained under torture are internationally or should be.
But since 9/11 and since Bush and the boys and the Patriot Act, it's a gray area now. Which is why Cheney is still running around to this very day, even though he's out of office, trying to convince people that torture is a good thing, particularly if you call it enhanced interrogation. But that the main thing is that they want to be able to use confessions obtained through torture as evidence and to be able to move on it, not only to arrest people, but to attack countries and to that type of thing.
Well, first of all, you can never even be forced to testify against yourself. And that's one thing that torture makes you do, and testify against yourself.
You
but then you implicate, then you implicate other people falsely. So now, you know, how many years later has this been since 1971?
38, 39 years.
Now you all are being brought back to trial.
The ones who are still living, right? Frank McCoy and Ed Ertelatz, the same two that were in New Orleans. They were embarrassed when their case fell apart, and it's personal with them. They had retired.
They're retired, aren't they?
Well, not anymore. Yeah. As soon as Homeland Security was a farm.
That's right.
Brought back out of retirement and deputized by Homeland Security, and they went immediately and gave them unlimited funds and opened up this case, because this case actually falls in line with what they're trying to do today. They knew that if they could get something like our case through, where they could use the confessions in order to gain a conviction, and they were more or less counting on the fact that this was a cop killer, which is horrendous, and most Americans, you know, rightfully, but if you say cop killer, mm-hmm. then, you know, it builds up resentment towards
right.
you. Then there's 8 black men, so mm-hmm. they were counting on racism, and we were Panthers, which they've already demonized us.
Absolutely.
So, you know, so
mm-hmm.
they felt that we can get this across, and if we can do that with them, then it sets a precedent, and we'll be able to do it. We can carry forward with our crusade to just torture people worldwide. So it was a ready-made case for them, until, unfortunately, it's not going very well because of the support of the people. And that's it.
No, fortunately, well, it's not going well.
It's
unfortunately
not going,
for them, it's
unfortunately,
not going
it's not,
well.
Unfortunately, yeah. Unfortunately
yeah,
for them. But it's because of the legal team that we have, which is brilliant,
mm-hmm.
and because of the tremendous amount of support.
Well,
that
you
we have
a lot of support. You have Nobel Peace Laureates Desmond Tutu,
yes.
Marie Corrigan McGuire,
yes.
as well as Cynthia McKinney,
yes.
Danny Glover,
yes.
some lady named Cindy Sheehan.
Yes,
I know.
She's a wonderful
supporting
person.
They're supporting you, and there's an open letter to Attorney General Jerry Brown to drop the charges, because Jerry Brown's actually the one that they finally found that would prosecute it, right?
They went to the district attorney here in San Francisco, and
Kamala Harris.
Yeah,
and
she refused,
right.
Based upon the torture and that type of thing.
Good for her.
And in Los Angeles, they went around, shopped around, mm-hmm. and the only person they could get to do it was poor Jerry Brown. And, you know, I think he wanted to, it was his, he's, you know, running for governor, and he wanted
Again.
His law and order credentials, and they lied to him. They told him they had a murder weapon, they had DNA, they had fingerprints, they had 300 witnesses. And I mean, if you come to me and tell me you got all that, I would think that it's a slam dunk. So.
But did they actually show proof, or did they just tell him that?
Cause, I think they just told him.
Or did
that.
He just look and say, wow, this is just a great political opportunity?
Opportunity. I honestly, I wasn't there, but that's about how I think it went. In my opinion, when the FBI and when police come to you and say, you know, we got this, and he needed them just like they needed him. So it was,
right.
you kind of have a tendency to say, okay, and with a wink or a nod or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. if you can do it, go ahead and do it. And they can't do it. Not really. Not they don't have any of those things. The murder weapon, they finally admitted a couple of months ago. They've been swearing to God that they had it or they can find mm-hmm. it, but they finally admit that it's lost.
And there's
lost.
Not any DNA evidence. Not.
No, they do have DNA.
Oh, they do?
It doesn't match any of us.
That's
though.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. It's
now,
not DNA.
You know, I'm
it's
surprised
not DNA
that they even
that
brought that up.
You, right?
Yeah, it doesn't match any of the 8. And the fingerprints.
Was it like a quarter fingerprint or something?
I don't know what they got. They're the ones who said they got it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then they turned around after they arrested us and had us in there for $5 million bail. And the attorneys got on him about it. And went, well, which one of them does it? They had finally admitted that it didn't match any of us. So why they even brought that up? I mean, why would you even say that?
Yeah, this is just really a clear-cut case of a miscarriage of justice.
Absolutely.
For sure. And not only that, but it's wasting so much money here in San Francisco when we have our
estimated $6 to $8 million already, and we haven't even had a preliminary hearing yet.
That starts
Monday,
the 8th.
Hopefully, the prosecution has been able to put it off successfully for
mm-hmm.
this 3 times already right. before, because they're not eager to go.
And you all are having a rally Monday morning.
Monday morning having a press conference and a rally starting at 8 o'clock in front of 850 Bryant Street. We're asking all of our supporters to be there. And anybody who actually believes in justice to be there, you may not even know about or care enough about the SF-8, but you should care enough about the legal system to the point to where people can't be framed and where where it's supposed to be what it is, justice, you know. And so
justice.
Just to ensure that justice is done.
There's two sets of justice in this country,
yeah,
right?
Well, one for them and one for us. Yeah, you know, and I'm unfortunately, I need both of them at this particular time because I'm not trying to spend, you know, if I'm convicted of something like this in which we are innocent and they're talking about life, you know, I would die in prison. That's a, you know, it's a death sentence for me and for all of us. We're all elderly men who've done everything we can all our lives to serve our community.
What have you been doing for the past 38 years?
Serving my community. Mm-hmm. I still, once they stopped me from being a Panther with a uniform, I just went to work for community-based organizations and did the same thing, serving the needs of people in my community right here in the Fillmore District.
Mm-hmm.
I worked with the WAPACT. I worked with the San Francisco Coalition. And for the past 20-some years, I worked at the LA Hillhurst Community Center.
Mm-hmm.
Helping people with jobs, helping people with housing, helping people with trying to stop gang violence and dealing with young people. I started several youth programs in order to teach peer mediation and to stop the violence. I helped form the African American. I was a co-founder of the African American Police Community Relations Board, which tried to mend the relationship between the police department and the black community so black people would have a voice when mm-hmm. something was done to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also a judge arbitrator working at the district attorney's office for the past 8 years, in which I actually oversee cases
mm-hmm.
from 850 Bryant. Now, I don't send people to jail mm-hmm. in the community court. It's an alternative so that if you come to my court and I preside over it, the worst you can get is community service, which I do believe in restorative justice, in which if you do something wrong in the community, you should give back to the community.
Try
to bring people together and mend things
as
opposed to breaking up families and sending people to the CDC, California Department of Corrections, where it's just cheap labor for corporate America.
And there's no rehabilitation anymore.
Not anymore.
It's just punishment.
It's warehousing and punishment. It's a business now.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a business for corporate America.
It's a prison industrial complex,
right?
That's
what it is. Absolutely.
Well, and you're saying $6 to $8 million so far, and the trial hasn't even started.
It hasn't.
How much, the programs you work on, how could that kind of money help the people of the community?
Oh, man. I mean, $6 million. You know, we're firing teachers.
I could have beaten Pelosi with one third of that money.
Yeah, well, I'm surprised you didn't beat it.
Yeah.
You know? But, you know, and this
closing
is just the beginning.
Schools, cutting services.
Right.
Our state is going bankrupt in June.
We'll be
gone.
You know, all kinds of people are losing their jobs. People are losing their homes. I mean, it's a trickle-down effect of where the economy is in a horrible position. We all know that. And they are talking about this trial may cost, if it goes and all eight of us are tried at the same time, it may go to $25 or $30 million.
Holy.
Because they're talking about a preliminary hearing that'll last 2 or 3 months.
Right.
But the trial may last 2 or 3 years.
Wow.
And
see,
if we separate it, if we are broken up and do it, it could be. I mean, whatever, you know, it could be triple that. You
this
know,
is,
so.
And, you know,
and
just
there
what
is
they
no...
do too is keep you distracted, keep your cash flow
depleted.
Yeah, depleted.
That was one of the things they did with us in the Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. If we had to, every time they arrested one of us, we had to bail them out. We had to get an attorney. It just broke the bank. I mean, they knew what they were doing when they arrested me 70, 80 times in 1 year.
Wow.
You know, so.
Well, even me on a much smaller scale, every time I get arrested in Washington, D.C., I live in California, I have to make two or three trips back there.
Right.
And so how can you stand up for your rights when it's going to cost you several thousand dollars to do that?
That we don't have.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely we don't have.
So,
and
then now,
they know it, too.
Yeah, they know it. And that's part of the process of breaking you down and putting you in a position to where they nullify you as any type of resistor to whatever it is that you're trying to resist. And, you know, when you represent the people, when you really believe mm-hmm. in freedom, justice, and equality, and you think that all people should be treated equally, that people should, you know, we have civil rights and human rights. When you honestly and truly believe that and stand up for it, you are going to be attacked. And they're going to do everything they can to make you look as a demon, to make you look like you're a villain, to arrest you. And if you're lucky enough, and if you're unlucky enough, they will kill you in this country.
And it's not only to demonize you, but it's also to send a message to other people, right?
And that's the main thing, and that's one of the biggest things that I really try to do now, is to let young people know that you have a right, that you have a duty and a responsibility to carry on. The struggle didn't start with me, and it's not going to end with me.
Right.
There were people before me, and there will be people behind me, and I'm asking the young people to step forward. Mm-hmm. It's their turn now. Mm-hmm. I'm tired. I'm ready to retire. But it's their responsibility, and they're standing on the shoulders of people who came before them, and I don't want them to ever think that you can't win, because you can.
I've had so many
victories along the way, you know.
Right.
And if I had it to do all over again, I would do it all over again. So that's what I want young people to know, and to know that they can win. Especially, they have a better shot than we did, and we really did a good job as the Panthers. We did. We made a significant difference in this country.
Oh, well, absolutely, and that's why it was disbanded, because you were making it.
Yes.
But thank you for that message to my listeners, because it is so important. And I've had the demonization on a much smaller scale than you guys ever did.
But I
would do, you know, except for losing my son,
right.
I wouldn't change anything.
I know.
You know, in the past 5 years since Casey died, and we hope that it would inspire people, you know, and I see you around the community, and you always hold your head high, and, you know, you have lived a life of integrity, and that should inspire, I would hope, young people to follow in you. Even though there might be oppression and there might be trouble, they still, like you said, it's their duty to do it.
Responsibility
to their community and to their families and to humanity and themselves, right? Who do you think really killed Sergeant Young?
You must have
thought about it down there.
I have thought about it recently a lot,
mm-hmm.
But so much time has passed, you know, and I honestly and truly don't know, except that there is someone who did that now.
Right.
You know, there was an article in the paper in which they came up and tried to implicate the eight with the young woman that was killed.
Right.
That was printed.
That was in the Chronicle.
The Chronicle. The other, whatever.
whatever.
And the crime is, I mean, this woman lost her life, and they imply that we did it to silence her or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But she was stabbed 71 times. They said, and to think that person is a psychotic,
person that really.
And that person is still out there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those type of things. And the person who killed Sergeant John Young,
he's still out there.
They're there. So, you know, and that's what I think about a lot. I think about that and wonder, you know, why they waste so much time and energy. But, I mean, they don't know either. They have no idea. That's mm-hmm. the bottom line, just like I don't.
Right.
They have no idea, but they have to make something fit somewhere. And why not Richard Brown and his boys, you know?
Right.
So that's the way they go about it. So, but no, I have no idea why that was done. Back then people were doing things like that. But who did it? I have no idea.
Back then, it's still happening, unfortunately.
It is still happening, unfortunately, today, that people are being killed for a number. I mean, what, in Iraq, people are dying. Thousands of people.
Iraq,
week,
Afghanistan,
you know.
Pakistan,
yeah, that,
now
you know.
Gaza.
And all of that was started on a lie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lie, just like this lie that's being perpetrated against us. You know, we got DNA, we got murder weapon, we got, you know, just the same thing about weapons of mass destruction. And then when you get down to it, where are they? They're not there.
And the establishment has their propaganda tools there over at the Chronicle
that can smooth it over and
our
so-called shoot you somewhere
paper
else.
Of record here in San Francisco. Well, Richard, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I've learned so much in this interview. It was a great interview. But I hope that you'll come back and we'll let us
be more than happy.
And,
to.
And we can learn more about the case and about how it's going.
Thank you so much for your support of the aid. We really, really appreciate it.
Well, if I'm going to be out of town on Monday, or I'd be there for the rally, you know I would.
I know.
Well, thank you, Richard, for being here. Good luck. And somehow I hope some kind of common sense
prevails.
And justice prevails. And we, as a city, as you're the San Francisco 8, as a community, don't have to go through this.
Thank you. Yeah. All power to the people.
All power to the people. Right on. Right. Thank you. Okay. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. This is Cindy Sheehan, CindySheehanSoapbox.com. We'll be right back with my soapbox rant. Thank you.
This is Jamie Romano of James Communications. We are living in such exciting times. Never before in history has the global community come together in solidarity as we are now. Wonderful work is being done locally, nationally, and globally on every human and environmental issue that needs to be addressed. I developed James Communications to help you maximize your contribution to the world. Whether you're a small group, a large organization, or an individual with an altruistic dream, if you're working in service to humanity or the planet, James Communications will work with you to streamline efficiency and strengthen the impact of your cause or campaign. For more information on how James Communications can help you do what you do, please visit www.jamescommunications.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. I did a mini rant at the beginning of the show, so in place of my soapbox rant, I'm going to read a rant from a listener, Gary Nicholson, and it pretty much just summarizes the way I feel too. To whom it may concern, it's time for all good people to get together and stop the wars. There's a lot of talk about racism in this world. These wars have racism written all over them. What is the premise behind these wars? Yes, I know you'll say, quote, terrorism, end quote. Define terrorism. Isn't it the murder of large numbers of innocent people, including women with children? That's what war is. The bottom line is, wars are mainly sold on hatred, and hatred and racism walk hand in hand. What is it about the Middle Easterners that make you want to hate them? Let's not forget Saddam Hussein. He was only guilty of the things that the U.S. and other countries continue to do. If you don't want terrorism, don't terrorize. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Those words were originated by a popular Middle Easterner by the name of Yeshua. Now look up that name and then come back and listen to this again. From Gary Nicholson. My Ask Cindy question today comes from, I don't want to say his whole name, it's Bill, and Bill's in Baltimore, Maryland. Dear Cindy, I suspect you don't see too many notes like this. I'm a combat veteran of Afghanistan who was very much opposed to your campaign against the Bush administration's prosecution of the wars there and in Iraq. While I was opposed to your message, I was a staunch supporter of your right to express it. I'm disheartened to hear of the rough handling you and your campaign are receiving at the hands of the mainstream media. However, I hope that you will continue your campaign and ultimately unseat Nancy Pelosi. I may not agree with your politics, but we sure as hell can use a lot more people in Washington who can disagree honestly and thereby bring true transparency to our government. Ultimately, this is in all of our interests. Best of luck, Bill. Well, Bill, I'm actually not going to run against Nancy Pelosi, but I take your point of how the media handled or didn't handle my campaign. When I went to Crawford, Texas, I couldn't even go to the bathroom without the media following me. And when I came to San Francisco to run against the Speaker of the House as an independent, I got on the ballot. I was only the sixth person in California history to get on the ballot as an independent because they make ballot access very hard. We raised a considerable amount of money. We waged a fierce and committed and dedicated and serious campaign against Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi and I have fundamental differences on many, many things. And then the media practically ignored our campaign. In fact, there was practically a blackout on our campaign. Our PR people even told us that they were told not to work on our campaign or they would never work in San Francisco again. They said they never had seen anything like it where they couldn't get an interview for me or they couldn't get our stories covered. So I have to believe that that was a concerted effort to stifle my message. I think if we had a fair hearing, and I think if Nancy Pelosi had agreed to debate me, that things might have turned out differently. Bill, and you might not believe this, but I get a lot of emails like yours. Your listener soapbox today is to go to the website for the San Francisco 8. It's www.freethesf8.org. That's S as in Sam, or S as in San, F as in Francisco, 8.org. And there is a letter that you can download and copy and send to Jerry Brown to urge him, along with me, Desmond Tutu, Mary Corrigan McGuire, those are two Nobel Peace laureates, Cynthia McKinney, courageous ex-congresswoman and Green Party candidate for president, and Danny Glover, actor, to drop the charges against the SF8. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I want to thank you, as always, for listening. I want to thank my guest, Richard Brown, and I want to wish him and his co-defendants the best of luck. And like I said when I interviewed him, I hope cooler heads prevail. As always, I'd like to thank Scott, my engineer, and Rich, my webmaster. Hey, while you're on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, go and download the other shows. Listen to our archives. Please pass the word along. Like I said, I believe that this is a show that is so fundamentally and profoundly important in our world today. And while you're on the website, you can go to the donate button and make a donation to keep this important program on the air. Thanks for listening.
I must make my witness. Have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller. And all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Cheers. They're yelling in Baton Rouge.